He's Tim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie's still waxing poetic about our encounter with Pope Francis over
there.
St. Peter's Square.
That's right.
Just about a week ago.
You might get some vibes from me in a positive direction, Jim. You know what I mean?
No, I think it's great, actually. You know, today's political panel, Marjorie, will discuss what many see as the Yawn-a-thon to succeed John Kerry, a rare bipartisan love fest in D.C., and what if Tom Menino just says no? Jennifer Braceras writes a column for The Herald, blogs at redmombluestate.org, and was a George W. Bush appointee. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Great. And Warren Tolman's a former state senator and a Democratic candidate for governor and lieutenant governor. Hello to you, Warren Tolman.
Good to be with you, Jim.
How about Marjorie?
And Marjorie.
It's a delight.
I haven't seen Marjorie in a while, so it's a real delight.
It is.
I used to chase you around on the campaign trail, though. I remember that a few years
back. I remember it fondly.
That's right. Okay, so the Herald today calls this special election a real sleeper and snoozer. Here's the Globe headline. Senate special election race lacks pizzazz. That's from a Frank Phillips piece for a couple of days ago. So what happened? What happened?
I think voters are just burned out.
You think so?
It's too close to the presidential. And I know that the candidates are having a hard time raising money for that reason, especially on the Republican side.
No Scott Brown to bring that sort of Cosmo sizzle to the race.
I don't even necessarily think it's about the people. It's Massachusetts Republicans have opened their wallets time and time again for losing candidates, and we're tired of paying.
You buying that, Warren Tolman?
A little bit, but you know, you had Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren. They raised the most money in the United States of America of any two candidates running for the United States Senate. They were it as far as all the congressional races went last year. So anybody, by comparison, is going to look less than those two.
Yeah, but this is when you're in a state, as you very well know, both of you very well know, where a Senate seat opens up every 30 or 40 years, there's got to be something more going on. One of the political analysts in the Globe story that Frank Phillips wrote said it's because there's so much attention on the Deval Patrick $2 billion tax and investing. Nobody's paying any attention to that either.
No,
so
I agree.
Maybe it's because the candidates just aren't that electric on either side.
Well, harken back to Martha Coakley, Scott Brown. Early on in that campaign, it was ho-hum because nobody thought it was going to matter. Martha Coakley was going to be the center. So here we have the same thing replaying, and potentially that bodes well for Jennifer and her team if Democrats don't wake up. But we have a long way to go, and they're just starting the campaign commercials. That'll raise the temperature a little bit.
We should ask, do you have a candidate in the Democrat side?
No, I don't.
Do you have a candidate in the Republican side?
Not yet.
Jennifer, you don't. So what handicap now, admittedly, the debate's 2 days away, so obviously that hopefully is going to be watched by a lot of people and may have some impact. Handicap where we are on the Republican side now, Jennifer.
I don't know where we are on the Republican side. We've talked about this before, you and I, Jim. I really want to like Gabriel Gomez.
He was
with us
Friday here and on TV, too.
Yeah, and I think he's the type of candidate that the Republican Party should be putting forward.
Why?
Well, because I think he's not a professional politician, because I do think his ethnic background is important. I think we need to have more diversity within the Republican Party, especially here in Massachusetts, where Hispanics make up the largest ethnic group now.
He should have run for selectman first. I think that's one of his problems. He's going right from zero, even though he's got this unbelievably impressive resume, you know, from his education to the Navy SEAL stuff to landing on the aircraft carriers. I can't get over that. People who land on aircraft carriers.
It's pretty cool.
I don't think he's gotten his, you know, when you ask him questions that he should know the answers to, he doesn't know the answers.
Well, he did run for selectman. He came in third out of three candidates, and that's part of the problem here.
Are you kidding? It's not exactly
the launching pad.
Barack Obama lost
States
by
Senate.
45 points
he
in
was
a congressional
state,
race.
He was a state senator, and he was a United States senator.
Elizabeth Warren didn't exactly have any political experience. I mean, it can be done.
It wasn't my point, Jennifer, that you needed political experience. But, you know, he did dip his toe in, and it wasn't that successful.
And on the Democratic side, the handicap thing, Marky, the reality
is terrible. If
excitement is that, because the Democratic infrastructure is for Ed Markey, at least the power people, and because the AFL-CIO, which, by the way, is the president of which is your brother, I should say, didn't come out for Steve Lynch, which I think he assumed they would or at least wanted to be. As of the moment, Markey's the favorite, is he not, by a significant amount?
Conventional wisdom is he certainly is. You know, a couple of things. Ed Markey also, to his credit, had a 95% labor record, so it wasn't like Steve Lynch, who's obviously a union leader, union president, was running against somebody who was anti-labor. Secondly, you know, this is right now, Steve Lynch has a good message. It's that, you know, I am Stephen Lynch. This is, you want to change things in D.C., you ought to vote for me. It's a pretty good message in this anti-incumbent time.
Don't you think, Jennifer, I mean, I know that everybody has gotten behind, a lot of the Democratic establishment has gotten behind Ed Markey, and he's doing well in the polls vis-a-vis Stephen Lynch. But, you know, we get a great quote in the Herald today saying Lynch is running like his hair's on fire. He's all over the state, running everywhere. He was back in the state this weekend, and Markey's been absent for a week, according to this story this morning. And it's
for
almost,
20 years, some people might say.
Exactly. So why can't Lynch come from behind kind of guy on the Democratic side?
Oh, I think he can. And I think a lot of the reason the establishment sort of coalesced around Markey before Lynch was in, and now they're going to stay with Markey because they're loyal and because they took a position. But who knows what people will do in the voting booth?
Yeah, to me, Lynch is so much more dynamic a candidate.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, Ed Markey's been my congressman, and he's been around, and I've seen him around, and he's been working, you know, not just for this campaign, but over the last 20 or 30 years, whatever.
Why are you smiling when you're saying that, Warren?
Because everybody, I know what you're going to say.
I'm
you
not
did
saying
it to
anything.
Me on
I'm
TV.
Just...
you run, there's a guy that looks just like you.
He's my evil twin brother, yes.
But you know, this is going to be a good heated campaign. It's all about getting your voters to the polls and energizing your
people. Well, I will say, having said that, I think that Lynch is the more dynamic candidate. I'll also say that as a Republican, he's the candidate I'd be more afraid of.
But what about that, getting the candidates to the polls? So if Markey does have so much of the Democratic establishment behind him, isn't he the guy that's going to get the big voter turnout effort in his corner?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. But you've got to get people that are going to vote in a primary. And, you know, the Democratic establishment, such as it is, and by the way, John Wallace, the Democratic Party, they're not taking a team. They're not taking a side on this. But those people who are issue-oriented is what Ed Markey is going after. His first ad was about the BP spill and some of the things, and now it's about guns and the like. So he wants to target those people on an issue-oriented basis and energize them. Steve Lynch has a little bit more difficult message because it's more biographical, at least up to this point.
But
Markey has a lot more money and a lot more resources.
But the people who come out and vote do tend to be union people, for example. And even though he hasn't gotten the endorsement of the big unions, Steve Lynch, I think, has the hearts and minds of a lot of those people. I understand politically.
I think we're talking to a crossover voter. Are we? Not, are we?
No.
I mean, we're not?
I understand politically why union leadership wouldn't want to endorse, because they're going to support whoever the Democrat is and they want to preserve that option.
Right.
So, but I think that the people, the workers themselves, are going to come out for Lynch.
I should say Steve Lynch has a lot more unions actively supporting him in terms of the gross number of unions.
Right, smaller unions.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move to the chamber where these five guys want to serve. The Senate, as you know, a couple of days ago, finally passed a budget after years. I think you could describe it as the best of times and the worst of times. Listen to Mitch McConnell, who is the Republican leader in the Senate, in rare praise for the Democrats.
Mr. President, I just want to commend Senator Murray, Senator Sessions, and you, Leader, for conducting an open and complete and full debate. I know everyone is exhausted, and you may not feel it at the moment, but this is one of the Senate's finest days in recent years, and I commend everyone who's participated in this extraordinary debate.
Now, that quote from McConnell, Jennifer Braceras, was at 4 something in the morning because they had an all-night session. Mm. And I wake up to hear this on the radio, and it says, again, one of the finest, Senate's finest moments in recent years. And I assume that meant that the vote was, what, 80-20 or something like that? The vote was 50-49. Not one Republican voted for the budget. But we have reached such a pathetic state in American politics that the fact that they actually had a debate is cause for the Republican leader to describe this as one of the Senate's finest moments. Well, I think it's one of the most depressing things I've heard in my lifetime.
It's one of their finest moments because they actually stood up and did their job, which I agree with you is pathetic. But for 4 years, they hadn't passed a budget.
But do you see
and
where
so
I'm going from
what
this?
He was saying is,
I'm sorry.
Was a little bit almost facetious, really, that he's saying you finally woke up and pulled it together and passed the budget.
I don't think he was being facetious at all. I think what he was saying was because you allowed unlimited amendments, which they almost leaders rarely do, and
it's
even though not one of the Republicans voted for it, and by the way, I'm not blaming the Republicans. The Democrats, for them, because they're scared about their elections, ended up joining the Republicans. Almost a straight party vote. You know, Warren, did you read the very long piece yesterday about the demise of the International Treaty on Disabilities in the Globe yesterday?
Yes, the Bob Dole.
Great piece by Bob Dole sponsors this thing as a former senator. It's got huge bipartisan support, including former Republican presidents, attorneys general, and then one guy comes in. He's the head of the Homeschool Association of America. That's not what it's called. Something like that. And scares the you-know-what out of it. Ultimately, a treaty that had huge bipartisan support goes down to defeat in the United States Senate. That and Mitch McConnell's comment both left me with this notion that we are in hopeless partisan gridlock that I just don't see how we ever get out of.
Well, Mitch McConnell's comments, ironically, Jim, finest moments, may actually be right, because it's compared to what? You know, here we had 500 amendments, 70 were voted on, and they're all advisory in nature. They don't even count substantively. They're not going to be passed into law. So the notion that somehow we're doing all this good politics and moving the dial in the Senate's finest hour is an absolute
disgrace.
Tell
me what you mean. There may be an individual bill. This can be there. Maybe it's immigration. Maybe it's not going to be guns, unfortunately. There's going to be some bipartisanship on something. But it seems to me that, again, these last 3 days represent to me the notion that there's no way out of this hole.
Part of this, though, as I said to you before, has to do with the media's lousy coverage of this. When we have these...
This being which?
Well, the disability,
Bob Dole
situation was a classic example. When you have someone getting up there and saying how a piece of legislation or a treaty or any whatever it is having to do with disabilities is somehow going to mean, you know, these government bureaucrats coming into your house and stopping your homeschooling and all these ridiculous things.
The United Nations was theoretically going to do that, the critics suggested.
It's the obligation of the media not to treat that as a legitimate argument, and we did. We kind of put it out there, and there was no one saying this is ridiculous. And I think the news media, you have to not, in an effort to be fair, you can't put ridiculous arguments forth as reasonable arguments. And we do that too often, if you ask me.
So well, neither of you know what the path out of the wilderness is, correct? I was hoping you'd make me feel better, no?
Well, I don't think we need a path out of the wilderness.
It's better to be in gridlock for the rest of our natural lives?
A little bit. I mean, our founding documents contemplate gridlock, right? I mean, the whole point of the balance of powers and checks and balances is that we're going to have these competing ideas, and that only when large majorities of people can come together will things get done. I mean, and part of that is to protect the rights of the minority. So, you know, our system contemplates this. It's you call it gridlock, I call it checks and balances.
It protects the minority unless the minority. I know
Jennifer,
this isn't the kind of minority
Jennifer,
man that happens to be disabled.
What about the air shows? Didn't you read this weekend that because of the sequester, there's going to be no more air shows? That they're
going to.
Hey, it seems to me there are a couple things going on. One that's probably bad news for the Democrats, Warren Tolman, and one that's bad news for the Republicans. On the bad news side for the Democrats is Obama at the in fiscal cliff days, a couple of months, had a huge lead on who do you, the American people, prefer on the economy. Now it's a virtual dead heat. On the flip side, it seems to me with these two debates on Proposition 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act this week, where the Republicans, many people think, are on the wrong side of history, bad week for public. Which matters more, budget stuff or this whole gay marriage thing, which is going to get huge profile in the next 48 hours?
I think, frankly, gay marriage in the short term. Gay marriage, but coupled with immigration and guns, the Republicans, in terms of every poll that I've looked at, are on the wrong side of the vast majority of those issues and the vast majority of the American public. So one issue after another. Now, maybe they'll move to the center on the immigration reform because people like Rand Paul have recognized that it's politically necessary. But in the large picture, I think, you know, people understand the budget problem, but they can't really grasp it. And until it affects them directly, they're not really concerned about it.
I think it is affecting them directly. I think the stagnant economy is a result, in part, of our failure to reach agreements on budgets and are continuing to run these large deficits. So my sadness is that I think the economic side is more important, but I think the public puts more weight on, you know, the sexy social issues, and that's what they make their decisions on a lot of times. And I think that's short-sighted.
You know, you mentioned Warren added guns to this list of issues that matter to the American people. You mentioned Gabriel Gomez before, and he was with us on the radio, he was with me on TV. He is a self-described moderate Republican mm-hmm. in one of the most liberal states in the country, wants to be the United States Senator. And what I was surprised, I knew that he was against the federal assault weapons ban. He's also against a ban on high-capacity magazines, and more incredibly to me, I was surprised, against universal background checks. What does that say to you, and how do you become a United States Senator from a state like this when your position is that across the board on the three major initiatives on gun control in Congress?
Well, he probably won't.
But that's part of the reason, is it not?
Well, Massachusetts is a liberal state, and so you can elect liberal Republicans like Scott Brown or Bill Weld, but I think if you're going to take you know, more hardline positions on social issues in Massachusetts, it's probably not going to fly.
Let me ask you something, Warren Tolman. You know something about Beacon Hill. The Herald reported on Friday that lawmakers are investigating one of their own for what House Speaker Robert DeLeo called, quote, serious allegations of ethical misconduct. They won't release the name of the person they're investigating, and they won't even release the details of the complaint. What do you make of that?
Well, I look at it, and on one hand, you say, my God, that's terrible. They should disclose. But that's exactly what the attorney general does when he or she is investigating someone, or the district attorney's office. If you can't, and particularly in this public situation, you can't indict them and convict them in the court of public law right away. Let's hopefully the fact finders do their thing.
But what about what the complaint alleges? I mean, aren't we entitled in the public to know at least what's being investigated? Is this some kind of monetary fraud? Is this some sort of, you know, criminal situation?
At some point, absolutely, Marjorie. I think that you have to shine the white light on this. But, you know, there is a point, if there are certain factors involved in this, you might readily be able to ascertain who it is and what it involves and the like. And the judge and jury come back before the person has had a right to defend him or herself.
Yeah, I have to say, I know nothing about it, but just having read what was published in the papers, I got the impression that it was some sort of privacy issue where, you know, almost a sexual harassment complaint where they were maybe protecting the complainant.
Maybe. I don't know.
But they never disclosed it. When these complaints, what were DeLeo's, what were the speaker's words again? How did he describe it?
Serious allegations of ethical misconduct.
Did you ever serve on an ethics committee when you were in legislature?
I did not, but I was in the legislature when we had to act on Diane Wilkerson and some of the issues that she confronted. And, you know, initially I didn't know anything about it. And eventually it all came out and we actually took a vote in the Senate on the issues that were before us. I think that's the way it should work. But let's hope, Marjorie, and I think this is where you are, this is not swept under the rug, that if there are serious allegations of impropriety, that we all hear about them in due time.
What, are you upset about this because they're...
It's a general sort of situation where you are asking people that run the Commonwealth, whether it's Bob DeLeo or the Senate president, who I think is even more difficult to get to talk to you, they won't answer your questions. And I think it's or at least give you a thorough explanation of why they're not answering your questions. And they're supposed to be doing the people's business.
But Martha Coakley or Carmen Ortiz would not be answering these questions either at this stage of the investigation because there's no indictment here. Nobody's been brought forth before.
Yeah,
we don't know.
Different.
The person may have been indicted, and we just don't know about it because there's a lot of people up there on the Beacon Hill.
We know they haven't been indicted because it just happened, apparently, within the last few days.
Yeah, but you know what the difference is here? Well, not a total. The first piece is it's a public official. And now, admittedly, that you could make the same analogy with Martha Coakley. But it's also a public official being judged by fellow public officials, by their colleagues. And I think despite your Wilkerson example, everybody knows there's a great reticence on the part of most elected officials to ever sanction another elected official. So if we don't shine that bright white light or whatever you described early on in the process, the likelihood is it's never going to shine, right? I mean, most of these things we never see the light of day.
The Globe once upon a time referred to me as Mr. Ethics pain in the ass, Jim.
You're Mr. Clean Elections thing, right?
No, but I'm with you on the fact that the light needs to be shined. The question is it in the first week, and I suggest that let's wait and let the people do their due diligence.
Well, the media has a role, so they should scout out their sources and get people to find a deep throat to tell them what's going on.
Marjorie, you're the woman for the job, I have a feeling.
Yeah, okay.
You
know? So is Menino going to run again for office?
I think he is.
Yeah, you think so? Warren Tolman?
I do.
Okay.
If he's able.
If he doesn't, and we already have John Conley, of course, he's on the city council. He's already announced he's going to run. John Conley, I think many people consider him to be a viable candidate. Anybody else you could see if the mayor decides?
Andrea Cabral, maybe?
Andrea Cabral.
Former sheriff of Suffolk County. Yep. Now she's the Secretary of Public Safety as of a month or two ago for Deval Patrick. She's possible. Who else?
I think Marty Walsh, a state representative from Dorchester, has said he'd run. Dan Connolly, the district attorney, has obviously run citywide before.
Globe says he's got almost $1 million in the bank, too, 800 and something. $1,000 is a lot of money.
And every at-large counselor, that means Felix Arroyo, Alana Presley, and Steve Murphy, will all take a look at
He's the president of the city council.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it is so incredible. We had this discussion. Who do we have this with last week? I can't remember, Marjorie. Or maybe it was when you were in Rome. It is amazing to me what control of the political process, not process, but political world, Tom Menino has. I mean, it's so hard to come up with a list of potential challengers in a city that, you know, is allegedly a hotbed of politics. And it's in essence because this guy totally controls for better or worse.
Mayor as long as I've lived here.
Well, so. He has been. He has been for 20-plus years. But it is amazing. In Boston, I mean, you're a local kid. You grew up here, Warren Tolman. And you think Boston is the place where you're supposed to have vicious debates, great political debates. Essentially, everybody sits and waits, with an occasional exception like Connolly, for what Tom Menino decides to do, no?
And this is not new. Kevin White, Ray Flynn, until they decided they were not running, they were the heir apparents. Kevin White, arguably in 1983, was going to face a tough race and took an exit off the stage. But Ray Flynn could have stayed there indefinitely, and I think the same is true with Mayor Menino.
Jennifer, you're a Republican. Do you think that Tom Menino has been there since 1993? He's had health issues. He's 70 years old. He's been the mayor for all this time. Do you think this is good or bad for the city if he runs for another term? I think most people think he's going to win.
I think the city's in pretty good shape overall, so I don't see it having a major impact one way or the other.
It's one of the reasons you live in the suburbs, correct?
Because it's Hey, I would live in the city. I would move back in a heartbeat.
The schools are a problem. You got four kids, right?
Yeah.
The schools are problematic to lots of us living in the city.
One thing that I think the mayor doesn't get credit for is bringing in and changing the talent that's in City Hall. He's not afraid of moving someone out. The commissioner of police, Ed Davis, I think is doing a tremendous job. People like Bill Oates, director of technology. I mean, we're a model for the rest of the country and what we're doing in Boston for urban areas for technology.
Well,
so he's constantly done that.
The other thing he deserves a lot of credit for, whether you plan to vote for him or Connolly, whomever, is the guy does not hide out in his office. We've talked a lot about this, but the percentage of people in the city who have met him, who have worked with him, who have dealt with him is staggering. And in my view, big city or small city, mayor or leader, your obligation is to go see people, and he's
out nonstop. He would go to the opening of an envelope, Jim.
I love that. I was setting that up for you. Warren Tolman, Jennifer Braceras, great to see you. Thanks to you both.
Too. Thank you very much. Okay, anybody looking at today's headlines could be feeling some serious cognitive dissonance. Violent crimes are down, but the number of people in the state behind bars has tripled since the 1980s. How come? And what needs to be done to fix our bloated prison system? That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
Warren, thank you. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. As Marjorie said a minute ago, there's a new report out by a nonpartisan think tank. It's called Mass Inc. It has two findings, amongst others, that you might think are in conflict. Violent crime is way down, but the percentage of Bay Staters in jail is way up. Here to explain how that all happened and whether it's a cause for concern is the head of Mass Inc. and the publisher of the great Commonwealth magazine. That'd be Greg Torres. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hi, Marjorie. Thanks for having me.
I tell you, one reason this should worry us is this costing us a fortune. How much is this costing, and why has this happened, Greg?
Well, that's the reason that Mass Inc. wanted to do this in the first place. We looked at a study that we did back in 2008 on overall state spending and realized that spending on public safety went from $600 million to $1.4 billion over a 20-year period. And that got us thinking about what was driving that, and that resulted in us doing this report. And what we found in this report is that over a 20-year period, we are looking at, as a result of tough-on-crime policies, we are looking at a price tag that is between $1 and $2 billion over the next 10 years. And when you think about the debates that we're having right now, for example, about transportation finance and taxes and so on, $2 billion on prisons over the next 10 years, and that's just operating funds. If you put in capital money, you're talking about another incremental $1 billion, so three altogether. That's of concern, and we need to do something about it.
So is this because of mandatory sentencing, or what's going on?
Well, it's a combination of things. We refer to it as a partly a front door problem in the system. That is mandatory sentencing, presumptive sentencing, determinate sentencing. Essentially, this get tough pattern that's emerged over the last 20 years, it started in the 90s, And then on the back end, we have been tightening parole eligibility. We have been limiting the number of inmates that are going out on parole. Over a 20-year period, we used to get 80% of inmates out of prison on parole with community supervision. 10 years later, it dropped to 60. Now it's down to 20.
Well, one of the big points you make, and we're talking with Greg Torres from Mass Inc., who looked at this whole problem of the huge numbers of people behind bars in Massachusetts, is that our recidivism rates are much higher than many other states, and we do a pretty bad job of transitioning prisoners from life behind bars to life in some kind of halfway house to life back on the street.
That's right. That's one of the things the report points out, is that we've been investing pretty heavily over the last 20 years in minimum and maximum security settings in our state DOC. By the way, counties there are some interesting reentry programs going on at the county level, but right now I'm addressing the state. We've invested very heavily in maximum and medium security facilities. It's very tough to make the transition from those facilities to the community without a tremendous amount of support and supervision and help. And we're just not very good at doing that.
So what does that mean? That you could be down, we're not supposed to call it Walpole anymore, the maximum security facility that is in Walpole. So you could be getting out of a maximum security facility like that and going straight back to the street without transition? I mean,
Yes,
that's
two-thirds.
Crazy.
Two-thirds of inmates released in 2011 from the state system went from maximum and medium security facilities. 10% from maximum.
With no jobs lined up or anything, or I mean,
well, 50% had no supervision whatsoever. It's called a wrap up. The inmates wrap up their sentences and then are released directly to the street.
Maybe they should just say, listen, I'll just stay and save the time. Hey, Greg Torres, a couple of questions here for us. We're talking to Greg Torres from Mass Inc. You know, I worry that when people listen to this, they say, good, we're tough on crime, even if it costs a little bit more. That's the way we want it to be in the wake of some very high-profile murders, and we'll talk about those in a couple of seconds that virtually everybody will remember. But what's most interesting to me is that a bunch of states, which you would think were the toughest on crime kind of states, the Georgias, the Texases, the Arkansas are going in the exact opposite direction that we're going, and as a result, not incurring a lot of these costs, correct?
That's correct, and that you're addressing the politics of crime and sentencing. Ironically, it is the conservative states that have addressed these issues over the last 10 years and are getting out of the tough-on-crime approach because it simply doesn't work and it costs too much. They can do that. They're led by conservative Republicans, and no one is going to accuse them of being soft on crime the way Democrats get accused of being soft on crime. So the ghost of Willie Horton, of other sensational crimes and criminals that have made their way into the public consciousness in Massachusetts lives. And we get what Kevin Burke, the former Secretary of Public Safety and Security, who co-chairs our coalition, calls the crime du jour approach to sentencing policy. And we've got to get away from that. We can't just keep letting sensational crimes drive policy.
Well, it's also, you make a very interesting point, which I hadn't thought about till you made it, Greg, about, you know, because liberals are defensive about being soft on crime and liberal Democrats essentially are in control in this state. It's sort of like only Nixon could have gone to China. You seem to be saying that, I know you're not advocating for or against, we really need a law and order Republican leader potentially in the state house, in the corner office, to lead the charge to take us away from this expensive sentencing and incarceration policy. Is that where you're going?
Well, I think that one of the most interesting things in the report is the last page, which lists the membership of the Massachusetts Criminal Justice Reform Coalition that is led by Wayne Budd, a former federal prosecutor, a Republican, Kevin Burke, Democrat, former Secretary of Public Safety and Security, as I said, and also a career prosecutor at the state level, at the county level in Essex County for 25 years plus, and then Max Stern, who's a very distinguished member of the defense bar and the president of the Mass Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. So we have Republican, Democrat, we have former prosecutors coming together, and then if you look at the membership of the coalition, we have, again, Republicans and Democrats, we have prosecutors in the defense bar, we have police chiefs and advocates, We have businessmen and women, labor representatives, and a number of what we call formers, people who held positions in the criminal justice system that are now retired or on the outside and free to speak their minds about policy.
Yeah, but that's the key point, Greg. You know what virtually everybody on the list has in common? They don't have to face the voters next November. Isn't that the ticket?
With one exception, the one elected official on the coalition is Sheriff Michael Ash, who's been the sheriff of Hampden County for over 25 years and is doing a lot of the things that we're recommending in this report and has been for over 20 years in Hampden County, and it works. He has faced the voters many times.
We're talking with Greg Torres, the president of Mass, Inc. and publisher of Commonwealth Magazine, about this new report that shows that we have huge numbers of people incarcerated in Massachusetts and a very bad recidivism rate compared to some other states. I want to ask you, my last question, Greg, is about the politics involved here. You know, there was a terrible tragedy when this Woburn police officer, John McGuire, was killed by paroled felon Dominic Sinelli. It was a big, big stink because Sinelli had a very long criminal record, and many people argued at the time that he should not have been out on the streets at all. He never killed anybody. He was armed robberies, armed assault with intent to commit murder, assault and battery. I mean, obviously, a very long record. But he was out. Now, when John McGuire was killed, the Woburn police officer, there was a big political stink, and Deval Patrick replaced many of the people on the state parole board. Now, was Sinelli a guy that should have been out in the streets, or wasn't he? Was Patrick wrong to replace the parole board, or wasn't he?
Well, there are two different questions there. He clearly should not have been on the street, and there are absolutely no guarantees in any parole system around the country that a mistake will never be made. That's clear. What the other question about was the governor right to replace all members of the parole board is a trickier question. I think it definitely had a chilling effect on the parole system. And as the current chairman of the parole board is fond of saying, this is Josh Wall, who's also a career prosecutor and was somewhat of a controversial appointment at the time. But he has said publicly that the best reentry program the system has is parole. And we are not using it appropriately. And we also have gotten into this business of having a lot of people come out of prison on probation, what they call a probation on an after sentence, versus parole. And probation is just not equipped the way parole is to manage those former inmates.
I know, Greg, last question from me. Greg Torres from SA. I know you're not in the blame game thing here, but it seems that with that exception of abolishing that commission, that Deval Patrick has filed a bunch of stuff that would lighten the prison load and give greater discretion to judges on sentencing. But it seems the legislature, Democratic-controlled legislature, has not been very open to any of this stuff. That's a fair statement, too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right, Jim. And that's the reason we wanted to pull this outside group together to say to those on the inside, we're ready to work with you. We will do the analytical work. We will come up with some of the proposals. We'll try to raise public consciousness about this very important issue. But we just can't keep spending this kind of money when you know, support for public higher education has been going down and down and down as a percentage of state spending for years and years. It just makes no sense.
Okay, Greg Torres, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it. Greg Torres.
Thank you, Jim and Marjorie.
Greg Torres, president of Mass, Inc., publisher of Commonwealth Magazine. Mass, Inc. has released this new study that shows what's wrong with our state's prison system. You can learn more about it at massinc.org. Okay, Jim, from the big house, we're going to the Beatles. It's been 50 years since they released their first album, Please, Please Me. What is half a century of the Beatles meant to you? That's next, a little nostalgia on Boston Public Radio.
The promise of the digital age, efficiency. It was supposed to give us back time, but somehow it doesn't feel that way.
You know, that sense that every ping, every vibration of my phone might just pull me out of whatever it is I'm doing into something else that seems somehow more pressing on the moment.
Douglas Rushkoff on Taking Back the Clock, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you, and Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting legendary vocalist Barbara Cook and singer and jazz guitarist John Pizzarelli at Symphony Hall on Saturday, April 6th at 8 p.m. You can learn more and order tickets at celebrityseries.org. And the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Alston community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu.
Gives me chills. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Doesn't it? I mean, it really does. Yeah. 50 years ago this month, the Beatles entered Abbey Road Studios in the morning. 12 hours later. That's right. 12 hours later, they'd finished recording Please Please Me. 50 years later, I don't care if you're 80-something, 18, or 8 years old, everybody loves the Beatles. Here to celebrate the anniversary with us is the man behind the Curiosity Desk, Edgar B. Herwick III. Hey, Edgar.
Hey, guys. How are we doing?
Jim may start crying any moment.
I'm telling you, it's just 50 years ago. So is this really true? They really did this in one 12-hour day?
They did. But now keep in mind, the idea here was they had already put two singles out, Love Me Do and Please Please Me, had both been recorded individually as singles. And each of those had a B-side. So they had four things which had already been recorded, and they had done a bunch of takes on those. So they had taken their time with those four tracks. Now, the Please Please Me album totals 14, so they had to record 10 more songs, which were done in three-hour sessions over the course of 12 hours.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If there's a favorite Beatles song, if you ever saw the Beatles, if a major moment in your life was tied to the Beatles, and particularly if you have a young kid, I love this, by the way, when you see like 10-year-old kids singing at the top of their lungs with the windows open in their car, song that was recorded 47 years ago. It's so great.
That was great. When did that number one album come out?
That was 2000.
2000. Okay. You didn't feel as much like a totally out of it loser because your kids were singing the Beatles songs that you were singing when you were a kid. So it made me feel a little more hip. You know what I mean, Jim?
Tell the story about the Twist and Shout. The legendary Twist and Shout was the final song recorded that day. Tell how that happened.
So this was a traditional closer for the Beatles. At that time, they had been playing their live act at the famous Cavern Club, and they'd also sort of cut their teeth in Hamburg, where they played for a few years together back and forth. They went to Hamburg and England. And it was a traditional closer because John Lennon basically, as he admits it, he says he screamed the vocals out, right? He wasn't even singing. He was screaming. So John Lennon, and actually if you listen to the entire Please Please Me album, you'll hear John Lennon, his voice is torn up through most of it. And they were worried. He was sucking cough drops, drinking milk the entire day, trying to keep his voice from totally shattering. So they save Twist and Shout to the end because he's literally screaming the vocals. And if you listen to that cut, and we have a little here. Just listen, his throat sounds like it's blasting open, and it is awesome.
Let's hear it. It's really unbelievable. Was it two takes? Is that what he did?
Think back to the bar mitzvahs.
What was it, two takes? Is that what he did?
They did two takes, but this is the first take. One take. This is one take, full take, everything you're hearing. They didn't even do overdubbing. They just mastered it after this. So this is what it sounded like in the studio. First take.
877-301-8970. 50 years ago this month. Please, please me. 50 years ago, they did it in one 12-hour session at Abbey Road Studios. It is true. It is really amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's an interesting thing. Please, please me. The song, which was the second single. So the first one was Love Me Do, and they had that went to like number 17 on the charts, which earned them the credibility to do a second single. And they had been fighting to do Please, Please Me, because you got to remember at the time the Beatles, they were wanting to record their own music, which was by no means the way it was done. And they had. Chutzpah, as they say. You know, they really pushed for it. And George Martin, to his credit, he sort of
legendary
let them go a little
producer.
Bit. The legendary producer, George Martin, he heard them out, but he was not happy with Please Please Me. Initially, it was written as a ballad. You know, John Lennon talks about he had Roy Orbison in mind, and it was very much a sort of sweeping, ballady kind of song. And George Martin was not happy with it. He said, it just doesn't work. He said, if you guys can rework it and make it work, I'll record it. So they went back, they sped up the tempo, they worked on it, they came back in, and they recorded it. And there's the famous story where George Martin, after they recorded it, said, congratulations, boys, you've just recorded your first number one single.
Is that apocryphal, or is that a true story? Do we know or no?
It's never been confirmed that it's totally true, but it's, you know, Ironically, it didn't go number one, though. It went number one on a couple of charts, but not the major chart in England. And it didn't go number one in America either, although it was among the five that eventually, when the Beatles held the top five spots in America, it was one of them when it got re-released. Yeah.
At the same time?
Yeah, they had the five number one singles
you
in America.
Remember?
At one
point. Those were incredible moments. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. You know what I also, when you hear back, when you go back to the earliest Beatles, it's so simple. I mean, I don't know anything about music, unlike you, Edgar. Well, everything was short.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is the structures of the songs, they're so simple. And you know what the other thing comes through to me when you listen to them? The joy that explodes through their voices on all these things is so infectious. It is unbelievable.
You know, they weren't doing the heavy-duty drugs when they first started doing these things.
Although they were, I mean, they weren't not doing any drugs. When they were in Hamburg, they were living in, like, the red light district in Hamburg, and they were playing these, like, insane sets. It's one of the reasons, I mean, one of the things that set the Beatles apart, and this is one of those things that's, like, an important lesson, I think, to anybody who's, like, trying to master a craft. They were insanely talented. There's no question about that. But they played all the time. They played these insane, like, 10 and 12-hour sets in Hamburg. And in order to get through that, the people who were working the bars in Hamburg where they were playing were sort of giving them some speed, these pills, these speed pills that they would take. So they were all hyped up on speed, and they're drinking, and they're playing these insanely long sets, like in the red light district in Hamburg. There's all these teenagers coming, people. I mean, just that scene sounds like it was absolutely incredible.
So, Edward, do you have a favorite Beatles song?
I have a – I mean –
That's unfair. That's,
I can't really pick
a
favorite.
A couple.
No, I have a number of favorites. I mean, they have so many different periods.
They
do. You know
what
I mean? So there's the – and I really love the early stuff. I mean, a lot of people like to be like, you know, the early stuff, whatever. I love the early stuff.
Me too.
You know, Please Me, the album is incredible. But I mean, I really zero in on the middle years. I love tunes like Hey Bulldog. I love, you know, Rubber Soul, the entire album. Revolver, the entire album.
I love Rubber
Soul. You know, I mean, I couldn't pick one. Strawberry Fields Forever – as sort of like easy as that is to pick as a favorite, is an absolute favorite. I mean, it's a masterpiece.
Three big smiles in the studio here at WGBH. 877-301-8970. Let's grab some calls. Deb, you're in the car. You're on with Marjorie, Jim, and Edgar. We're talking Beatles 50 years after Please Please Me. Hey, Deb.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you that in 1963, I saw the Beatles. I was all of 11 years old.
Ah.
And I saw them at Atlantic City Convention Center. They had set up a pre-Shea Stadium show, and it was just a small venue. They had blocked off all of the seats for about 30 rows back. They were on stage with tiny little amplifiers that you could barely hear anything because everybody was screaming insanely. And as a little kid wearing her little knee socks and little, I just walked down up front with my Polaroid camera and shot a photograph, and I still have it today.
That is unbelievable. Deb, when you say it was a small venue, how many people were there?
There was probably about 4,000.
That's a pretty small venue.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty small.
So where's the photograph in your house, Deb?
I actually have. I rediscovered it, and I have glass cabinets, and I just stuck it in one of the little cubbies of my glass cabinet. So
That's
everyone
great.
That comes to my house is amazed that I have this photograph of the Beatles. You have to look twice at it and realize you could see it on their drums, the Beatles.
Hey, Deb.
You know it's them.
Great story. I remember, and thanks for the call, speaking of the Beatles on the drum, Ringo Starr's drum, Ed Sullivan. Whenever you see the videos from Ed Sullivan, you see him introducing the boys, and then you see the Beatles on the drum kit. It's really...
I remember the controversy because they wore the jackets and ties, and they were better dressed than, of course, the Rolling Stones.
That's right.
were a little bit more sexual, and your parents took a very dim view of them.
Well, the Rolling Stones really, you know, the Rolling Stones were sort of... They actively pursued being a counterpart to the Beatles. And that's a big part of their success. I mean, they came from England, and the Beatles had locked up sort of cute and safe and musical, and the Rolling Stones needed to sort of have their shtick. And in some ways, like, you know, the Beatles helped create the Rolling Stones because of that, because the Rolling Stones defined themselves by being not the Beatles, by being sexier, by being bluesier, by being a little bit more of a group of bad boys, you know?
Well, let's get some people's favorite songs so we can play a few of these things and entertain you with the music. Let's go to Ellen from Hanover. Hi, Ellen.
Hello, Ellen. Whoops.
You're back on the radio.
Thank you so much.
Missed you and tell everybody where you are. So, anyways, number one fan. But the song I loved most was Norwegian Wood.
So did I. I love that song so much.
I love that song. And American Idol, I think it was last week or something, had to play Beatles songs. And I was so amazed to hear that none of these young artists were even remotely familiar with the Beatles songs.
Wait, they weren't familiar with them, or they just didn't perform them well?
They had to listen to them. They had never heard them before. It was just, I guess I'm showing my age to think that they couldn't have possibly known any of these songs.
Well, that's why American Idol's ratings are right in the toilet, Ellen. Right there is the answer.
You're right.
Thank you,
Ben. One more thought.
Sure.
It was around the time I was studying for my bat mitzvah, and I would go between listening to the recordings of the Beatles to listening to Baruch, you know, that whole thing. And so that's the memory that comes to my mind.
Beautiful.
Thank you guys for being back.
Hey, Ellen, thanks. You're very sweet. Thanks. Bye. That's a great story.
You know, you may be too young to remember this, Edgar, but Anna Quinlan, who was a great columnist for the New York Times, wrote a column talking about how girls in high school, you could tell who they were by who their favorite Beatle was.
Right.
So if you were a Paul girl, you were sort of a good girl. You
safe,
might have been
cute,
a cheerleader.
Yeah.
John was more intellectual, you know, and George was kind of alternative out there. I'm not sure where Ringo came in on the whole thing.
Neither was Ringo, actually.
Ringo, he was nobody's favorite, so nobody ever had
but
this.
But it was just great.
Everybody, the conventional wisdom is that Ringo's the luckiest man in the history of the world, as we know, because he wasn't part of the original foursome. Can he play? I mean, could he play?
You know, anybody will say, and the Beatles will defend him, Ringo was not the best drummer, but they all say Ringo was the right drummer for the Beatles. And that's actually true. I mean, Ringo, it's interesting because their first hit, their first song, Love Me Do, which was recorded, they had when they auditioned with Pete Best, who was the original drummer. Mm-hmm. And everybody at Parlophone, which was the label, had agreed Pete Best wasn't going to work. And the Beatles kind of knew this at this point anyway. So they come in and they record it again with Ringo. And a week later, it gets recorded a third time with a session drummer named Alan White, because George Martin was just like, Ringo's drums are not up to snuff on this. And that actually becomes the single that gets recorded. It's the one that's on Please Please Me.
Oh, that's a great little
and,
anecdote.
Yeah, and you can tell the difference of the versions. There was a first pressing of the single which had Ringo on it. They quickly put a new version out, and that's the version we all hear. The one with Ringo has a tambourine in it. You can hear. Actually, we have some of Love Me Do, I think. Let's hear a little bit of it.
It's
and
coming
with
in
the drum.
Second.
You hear that tambourine hit with the drum? That's Ringo on the tambourine while session drummer Alan White is playing
the
drums.
Yeah, I can play the tambourine. You know what's amazing? Either of you ever read an interview? We'll get back to your calls in 1 second, 877-301-8970. Ever read an interview with Pete Best, who was the original drummer?
Yes.
I read one about 10 years ago. And he says, at least in this one interview, he says, nah, I'm over it. Do you think there's ever a minute in Pete Best's life where he does not put his head, I don't know if he's alive anymore, in his hand and say,
are you
kidding? My God.
He's just got a picture of Ringo with one of those red circles and a line through it, like sitting in his bedroom.
Let's
go
out to Westboro where Paul is on as we're discussing the 50th anniversary of Please Please Me. Hey, Paul.
Hey, two things quickly. One, what's so special about the Beatles is they basically started as a boy band, Britain's greatest vocal group.
That's true.
And they ended, you know, with the White Album as one of the most incredible alternative bands of all time. And in terms of favorite songs, Edgar, you mentioned Hey Bulldog.
Yes.
Which, one, is stunningly underrated. And
I agree.
Two, it's the very last true Lennon and McCartney co-written song. It was during the Lady Madonna sessions. They had a 3-hour break. They had time to kill. John got in a cab, went back to get these lyrics they wrote in like 63 or 64.
You're right
and
on the money.
It's a fabulous song, and it sounds, and they're having so much fun playing it.
Yeah,
let's hear a little. We have a little bit of it. Here
some,
it is.
Yeah, this is some
of, before
some
you
of Paul's
go,
best when, bass playing.
Now, you should say, for people who don't know, when you say, well, let's listen for a second.
Listen to that bass.
Now, when Paul said a minute ago, Edgar, that was the last true McCartney-Lennon collaboration.
Yep.
While all of the songs said Lennon-McCartney, McCartney-Lennon, in essence, one would write the song and the other would get his name on it, for
That's
the most
right.
part in later years,
it
right?
It was a songwriting partnership. Certainly early on, they would literally sit and write together all the time. And the reason for this, it's actually the reason for this, is because, you know, in those days, the Beatles had, with the help of management, they had set up their own company, which was called Northern Songs Limited, which was so that they could own the rights at least on some portion of their music. So it was a licensing thing. So it just so happened that anything that was a Lennon song or for a McCartney song because of this licensing agreement that they had entered into was credited as Lennon McCartney.
Are you as one of the Paul? Thanks for the call. We'll get to more calls in a second. One of the real problems I've had through all the years, I assume most people have, when someone does a Beatles cover,
yeah,
you really need you know what's to do that. That's number
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
And number two, can't you list on one hand the decent? Joe Cocker did a couple of decent Beatle covers.
And the Beatles love that version.
Is that really true?
He does it with a little help from my friends.
Yeah, beautiful.
They're all, every one of them to a man says, that's better than ours. That's better than
they
ours.
They say it's better than ours?
They say it's better than theirs.
Nate, what's the best Beatle cover of all time?
That's definitely up there. There's a handful of good ones.
I don't know if this is the best one, but I like Neil Young singing at the, remember the 9/11 concert?
He did A Day in the Life. Well, that's not a, that's post. That's
John Lennon.
But he also does A Day in the Life. He's done it at Farm Aid.
Yeah.
His solo but it is staggering.
There's,
I mean, absolutely staggering.
I'm trying to think. There's one Beatles cover that I like in part because it's totally different. Do you remember that group from the 90s, The Breeders? They had that song Cannonball.
It's two
sisters, and one plays bass. One was in a band called The Pixies.
Breeders.
And they did a version of Happiness is a Warm Gun, which is like one of these kind of cool John songs, which like kind of has four different parts to it. And they do it so different and so interesting that that works. I mean, I think if you're going to do a Beatles cover, you got to do something completely different, because if you're going to do it straight ahead, you're not going to do it better than that.
Let's go to the phones.
Michael from Leominster. What's your favorite song, Michael?
Hey, my favorite song right now is She's Leaving Home, because it's absolutely haunting and beautiful. And the first time I ever heard the song was seeing Paul McCartney do it live in Boston.
Wow.
Where, at Fenway or where?
I've seen McCartney three times. I saw him in 2002 at, I guess it's the Garden again.
This is hauntingly beautiful.
Yeah.
It's true.
So this is from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. You really hear George Martin's influence on this with the orchestration. George is the guy who really instrumented all of this stuff. He laid all of this out.
So, Michael, do you like seeing McCartney in his 60s? Or do you say to yourself, you should have let it be, so to speak? And I that ended up as a pun. I didn't mean it as such. How do you feel about McCartney in his 60s?
Well, I mean, my problem is I was born in 1986, so that's all I have. I never got a chance to see John, who's my favorite Beatle, and I never got a chance to see George. So I will take Paul McCartney at 70. I think he sounds fantastic. Obviously, it's not the same as it used to be.
True.
But the fact that he's still out there and doing it, I'm very grateful. And I've seen Ringo four times, so that's all I can see. I mean, you had a caller earlier who saw them.
1963 in Atlantic City, yeah.
10 or 11, that's when I started getting into the Beatles, was in third grade, and the first song I ever heard was Hey Jude. But
that's great.
That's a good one.
I'm very lucky and fortunate that I've been able to see two Beatles, and I was able to also meet John's son, Sean, a couple years ago in Boston. So.
Cool.
Wow.
Hey, Michael, speaking of meeting, thanks for the call. Marjorie knows I lived in New York City for 15 years,
yeah.
And because I'm 6'5", you could see down into crowds of people better than others. The one most exciting handshake in my whole life. Lennon and Yoko Ono used to walk around New York City. They loved New York City. They were not hiding out. Lived on the Dakota, on the west side, on Central Park West. And seeing the two of them was maybe the most exciting moment in my life. I also saw...
Wait a minute, did you shake their hand?
Well, not hers. I also saw his first concert the Beatles did. I just thought of this minute. First concert that the Beatles did after they broke up was John Lennon at Madison Square Garden. It was a fundraiser for a group that Geraldo Rivera, a young reporter, did for a facility, an institution that was serving the mentally ill and was not doing a terribly good job. That's how Geraldo became famous. Geraldo Rivera introduces John Lennon. The stage is black, and all you hear acoustically is Lennon singing by himself, Power to the People.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden the lights come up, and it's John Lennon, I think Yoko Ono, and a bunch of band members.
The plastic Ono band.
All in white, and it was just in Madison Square Garden.
Unreal.
It was really unbelievable.
Did I tell you, Edgar, he was going to start crying?
Well, I am weeping.
I see the tears in his eyes a little bit right now.
Let's squeeze in one or more quick ones, Marjorie.
Is it Sonia from Seekonk?
I'm from Seekonk. Yes.
Hi, Sonia.
Hey, Sonia.
Hi. I just wanted to say, well, first of all, I'm younger than the true, real Beatles fans, but my mom, I have a great story. My mom was a New Yorker at the time, and she was the first person in North America to win the Beatles double album, to have the Beatles double album, because she won a radio jingle.
Oh,
and
wow.
She can't remember if it was A, Beatles, C, or A, B, Scene of the Beatles. She can't remember, but of course, then I grew up as a Beatles fan, and I think my favorite song would be On the Long and Winding Road.
That was their number one hit. Interesting about
Thanks,
the Long and Winding
story.
Road is that it's the one song of all of those Beatles number ones that that came out in that album, which was 27 number one hits between England and America. That is the only one that George Martin, the great producer, did not produce. That one was handled by Phil Spector after the fact. This was on the Let It Be album, which they recorded while they were breaking up.
You know, it was amazing. We were discussing upstairs, we went down the list of the 27 hits on that number one album, and I was amazed that none of them were written by George Harrison.
I think
one of my favorite songs is
written by George Harrison.
Here Comes the Sun.
Upstairs, Here Comes the Sun. Is that written by George Harrison?
He wrote that in Eric Clapton's backyard, in his garden.
Was that before or after Eric stole the wife?
Before. Just before. And in fact, something, talking about something, that song, Something, is written about Patty Boyd, who was George Harrison's wife, and then would later become Eric Clapton's wife, and he wrote Layla about her. So the song Layla and the song Something, two of the great songs in rock and roll history, both written about the same woman.
Just one more call. Carol from Cambridge, thanks for calling.
Hi, I saw the Beatles, I think it was in 1964 at Boston Garden.
Wow.
My best friend, and her father, who was like a saint, offered to bring me and my best friend from Worcester to go to the concert with us. And it was, my main memory was how much fun they seemed to be having up there. They were really joyful. They were, smiling, looking like they loved each other. They loved the crowd. They were just great entertainers. I think people don't realize how much, because of our whole history, but...
Carol, when you see the video from Shea Stadium, which is actually the only earlier video that I've seen repeatedly, one, you can't hear one word because the screaming
They couldn't hear themselves
so
either.
Loud.
They talk about that. They're like, I don't know
and
if I'm in
the
concert.
Joy, fainting.
Exactly.
And
Carol so captured it. The joy is so intense.
It was small enough that we could hear them. I mean, I was a little frustrated. I remember because people were screaming, but I was trying to hear them, and you could hear them because it was only probably 15,000 people. So
only, yeah.
And also with my friend's father took us to the hotel where they were staying, and my friend and I tried to get to their floor, but snuck up the stairway. There was a wall of cops there. We thought nobody would think of going up the stairway, you know?
Somebody apparently did.
Of the elevator.
Hey, Carol, great stories. Thanks for sharing. We appreciate it.
Two things real quick, Jim. One, you talked about that Shea Stadium concert.
Yes.
And if you want to talk about the unbridled sort of joy of the Beatles, go to YouTube, find it. Them doing I'm Down at the Shea Stadium concert, that particular song, there is nothing that captures the Beatles having fun better than that. They have an organ out there, which was something new that they were doing. John's screwing up all over the place. They're laughing at each other. He starts playing with his elbows. They're screaming and crying and laughing. It's unbelievable. And just in closing, and it's funny that we keep talking about this unbridled joy thing, because frankly, that is what got the Beatles started. George Martin had heard their audition sort of acetate, as it was, you know, he listened to it and he wasn't that impressed. And then he met them. And when he met them and they had that charisma, that joy, that like way of being, he was completely charmed by them as people. And that's why he gave him a shot.
I get it. I could see myself totally passing out and fainting dead away if I was at one of these concerts. I mean, you just got swept up in that whole hysteria. I could see you. Maybe just...
I'm ready to pass out right now. Like, you know, one of those concerts.
Okay.
Edgar, you were great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
He is Edward B. Herwart III. We've been talking about the Beatles with him. And Edgar, of course, is the guy behind the Curiosity Desk. Up next, it's open mic. It's open mic every day at 1 o'clock today. Reverend Eugene Rivers. Keep your dog with us, 89.7. WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Well, I never thought I would be addicted to gambling. I never thought that I would be addicted to anything. I like to shop. I mean, who doesn't?
Joan is not alone. Treatment for gambling addiction in Massachusetts is already in demand. But funding for that treatment has been cut as the Bay State awaits the arrival of three casinos. I'm reporter Anne Mostu. Our story on preparing for gambling addiction. This afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Middlesex Savings Bank, offering a wide range of mortgage products, including jumbo loans up to $2 million. It's one more way Middlesex has helped build communities for more than 175 years. More at middlesexbank.com/mortgage. And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, offering complete health care for you and your family. With 21 locations across Greater Boston, Harvard Vanguard welcomes new patients and accepts most insurance. HarvardVanguard.org, an affiliate of Atrius Health.
He joins us every Monday at 1 o'clock on Open Mic here on Boston Public Radio. He's the co-founder of the 10-Point Coalition. He is Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. Hey, Reverend Rivers.
Hello, good people.
Hello,
were you a Beatles
Reverend
fan when you were
Rivers.
A kid or no?
Isn't that that's a great question. You know why?
Why?
Because in the 60s, right, if you were black, you were R&B. We were Motown.
Oh, Motown.
No, 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 think about
well,
it,
if
right?
you were white, you were Motown, too.
So the funny thing was, we were fascinated by the Beatles. We didn't know where they came from. And since
we didn't
all
know
of,
where they came no, from.
And because all black kids in inner cities listened to black R&B programming.
Yeah.
We only discovered who the Beatles were because somehow black people watched Ed Sullivan.
That's right.
Right, I guess there was nothing else to watch, right? So we'd watch. So I saw the Beatles, you know, on Ed Sullivan, never listened to the music because I was doing all R&B. It's all 60s Motown black radio programming. So that's all we did.
But when you think about it, I mean, that whole 10-year period, what great music there was.
That's
you know, the
incredible.
Beatles, the Stones, all the Motown
yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
the Supremes. I mean, the whole era was just fantastic.
It's amazing. And then I find out 20 years later that the Beatles and the Stones had been studying R&B stuff. And
oh.
then a lot of this, that completely blew my
Little
mind.
Little Richard and all
of oh,
I mean,
oh,
so
oh, no,
many.
It was amazing. It was absolutely an astounding period, right? So I had an appreciation for the Beatles once I knew they loved Smokey Robinson.
Okay.
Smokey
okay.
Robinson, who, by the way, in 2013 looks like he looked in 1963.
Isn't that crazy? Isn't that amazing?
And he sounds pretty good,
oh,
too.
No, he does. It's pretty amazing.
So back to Boston, Reverend Eugene Rivers. The 10-Point Coalition, which you have been very involved with
yeah.
for years.
Co-founder, yes.
The co-founder, Reverend Jeffrey Brown, is stepping down as the executive director, says that they need younger leadership at the 10-Point Coalition. What's going to happen? I mean, the 10-Point Coalition, people don't know, has been very
Amen.
Involved in fighting crime in the city of Boston for...
The last 20 years.
Yeah.
Last 20 years.
So who's going to step in and,
well,
and fill
no,
the...
Well, see, two things have to happen. There's a great old black preacher line, which is, there is no success without succession. Okay? And since we're black preachers that founded the organization, we have a tendency to suffer from the founder's disease, which is we don't know when to make our exit. Right? It's a preacher thing, I guess, right? And I think the challenge for Reverend Hammond, who's chair of the board, you're from the board for 14 years, right? Hopefully in the 14-year period, you've cultivated new leadership. Very simple.
Have you?
No. We have failed. It has been a failure.
Is that an intention? And by the way, when you say it's and I'm paraphrasing, a black pastoral disease, the reality is everybody is torn no matter what they do.
Right.
You want to be a mentor to
right.
young people so they succeed you, but you don't want young people
you
to be
too
good, too
good,
fast.
Exactly.
And,
no,
I'm serious.
But think about this. And I said this in an article, and it got edited out. I basically said the same thing Larry Harmon said on Saturday.
Larry Harmon wrote the piece in the Globe.
And I said to myself, how do you not cultivate new talent in a city with 80 colleges? How's that work?
That's a very good point.
So what's the answer? How'd you answer your own question?
Well, basically, that is, organizationally, a failure of leadership on the part
including
of those.
Including yours?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
No, we, Reverend Hammond, Reverend Brown, and myself— if we have not produced new talent, we failed because the organization now pivots on the individual personalities of some preachers. And that's organizationally, right, a failure.
Well, tell people why the 10-Point Coalition even matters. Why is it important?
The Boston 10-Point Coalition matters actually nationally, you know, because Boston was the first city in the United States at the height of the crack epidemic to negotiate a political truce with regards to law enforcement. I mean, and the big miracle of Boston really was that Boston was the first city to de-racialize law enforcement. Every other major city in the country, especially when you think about the history of Boston with Charles Stewart, Willie Bennett, the case where the white guy kills his wife and blames the black guy. Right?
Willie Bennett was the guy who was arrested and
that
allegedly
right.
was the killer until
right.
everybody found out the killer was the husband.
Husband, exactly.
Yeah.
And so what's unique about Boston, and I think the signature contribution locally and nationally, is that the Boston 10-Point Coalition departed from black political discourse in saying, A, we're going to own crime. B, we're not going to play the race card. C, we will develop strategic alliances between a largely Irish Boston Police Department and black clergy with, actually, the assistance of Tom Menino, who, you know, mayor of the city, who was actually very, very good, extremely good on this, and Cardinal Law, who helped negotiate the truce between the Irish cops and the black clergy. An amazing story.
And you pointed out last time you were here, or maybe it was the time before that, but that Sean O'Malley, the cardinal of the Archbishop of Boston now, has not been involved in the black community nearly as much
as
Law
was. See, one of the things that the black community would like, I'm talking about black religious leaders, is to be engaged more with Sean O'Malley,
right,
given the enormous institutional influence of the Catholic Church, which is not the way it was when Law was here, and we've had that conversation.
Yeah,
right?
But there's some evangelical Catholic churches that are in the city, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're charismatics.
Yeah.
Those are
charismatic,
you know,
Catholics.
Charismatic Catholics are basically Pentecostals who drive Volvos. That's a great line. Isn't that good?
It's a great line, he says himself. So let's stay in current events for a couple of seconds. Yeah, you need succession. Yeah, you need young leadership. Yeah, you failed, as you described.
Oh, yeah, it's a failure.
You and Ray Hammond, Jeff Brown, whatever.
Yes, absolutely.
So why should one think this thing survives? They talked about the rotten financials. Paltry, I think, was the adjective
paltry.
that was used by Larry Harmon.
Yeah.
So the finances are bad. The person power within the organization, at least staff, is at a low ebb.
Yeah.
You haven't cultivated new leadership. Why should people not worry, or at least predict, that this thing is hanging by a thread?
Because there are conversations that are going on in the city about developing new leadership. There are actually a series of conversations that say, listen, you can't use an 8-track tape in an iPad world. And this is actually very interesting, because one of the things in the article that's pointed out is that we have different kinds of gangs. There is a gang called the New Movement. You've heard it here first, right? The New Movement, run by a 14-year-old kid who looks like he's 12. And there are 40 kids involved in the gang. And the new paradigm is that, one, you've got to intercept kids as early as 10. That's number one. Number two, what's interesting is that in 2013, the street corner is now the internet, Facebook, and Twitter.
Yeah, that's well.
Even in the gang world.
In the gang world.
About,
oh, no, absolutely.
And one of the great things I thought was pointed out in the same Larry Harmon article was that many parents are literally stunned to find out their kid is in a gang, that they're able to fool their parents quite regularly. And it's really hard. I mean, you hear this all the time in certain parts of Dorchester and Mattapan and Roxbury, where a kid has the best intentions. Moms tell them, stay out of the gang. Dads tell them, stay out of the gang. Why is it so hard to stay out of the gang?
Listen, I'm a good kid. I'm going to some school, and then I get my butt beat every day. I got drafted into a street gang when I was 12. They tried to drown me in the boys' room toilet. Isn't that amazing? They threw me in the stall, picked up my legs, and tried to stuff my head in the toilet.
In school?
In school. I was in eighth grade, and they tried to drown me in the toilet.
To get you into the gang?
Yes.
Where were you at the time, James?
I was in Philly.
Uh-huh.
So you joined the gang?
I joined. I was drafted, yeah.
Yeah.
I was drafted into the street gang.
But that happens a lot.
Listen, and all I wanted to be was a kind of solitary, artsy guy, stay to myself, mind my business. I get my butt kicked, they throw me in the stall, they try to drown me in the toilet, which is just an amazing visual, right? And
no, it's
I got
not.
Drafted. Yeah, I got drafted, and by the time I was 13, I had a .38 revolver in my hand. And I came from a family where my parents are going to college and my grandparents are going to college.
Did they know you were in the gang?
Oh, no.
Hey, can we get back to the comment you made a minute ago, is we're now cultivating young leaders, again, with the words you described a minute ago.
Yes.
But then you get away from the topic. It sounds to me like the concept is one that you and your colleagues have embraced.
Yes.
But the walk in the walk is not as successful as the talking of the talk.
Listen.
I don't mean historically.
I'm talking about today. Look. I am in conversation with Reverend Jeffrey Brown, and we are encouraging Reverend Hammond to do likewise, to engage in leadership development today. In other words,
you're making it sound like the chair of the board for more than a decade, Reverend Hammond. He's been reluctant to do this.
I'm not going to get into that. Now I'm not going to get into that.
But that is what you seem to say.
All we got to say is this. It didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm sitting on the chair of a board for 14 years, God bless me, right?
Mm-hmm.
After a while, that gets a little old. Just gets a little old, right? And if I'm a good leader, I reproduce myself. And it's the line I had a whole preacher tell me. He said, Rivers, you got to decide whether you want to be a star or a leader. A leader reproduces. A star comes and goes.
But is there enough time to reproduce?
I think so.
You think there is?
So. Oh, yeah, no question.
Well, let's move on to another current event. This week, the Supreme Court is going to be hearing all these oral arguments about Defense of Marriage Act and the Proposition
8.
And the black clergy historically has been not keen on gay marriage. But things have changed since Barack Obama came out in favor of gay marriage. And as more and more black Americans, non-clergy, just regular black folks, have embraced.
Plus the 60% support. In the black community, according to recent polls.
But I'll tell you what's interesting. It's complicated in the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question in response to that.
Yeah.
Why does it appear as though There can only philosophically or politically be one position on this now.
Well, what is it? You're either for gay marriage or against gay marriage.
No, no, no.
What's
the
third position?
Either you're for gay marriage or you're 20 seconds shy of a Nazi and a barbarian.
Well, you're not 20 seconds shy, but I think the movement has become now, because gay marriage has happened, if you're just doing the civil unions or you're doing steps short of that, you know, on a practical level.
Or you're doing
level,
no step.
You're losing a lot of benefits. But on a philosophical level, you're treated unequally. So that I think
that's the issue.
I'll
tell you what. See, from the church side, because – three things. On this issue, the churches have failed in two very powerful ways. We have had no compassion for women or gays, number one. Number two, we have been breathtaking hypocrites. I mean, it's just stunning.
You include yourself in those categories. I know. Do you not? On this issue?
As a member of the church, yeah.
No, as an I would argue, Gene, the single most uncomfortable moment you've ever experienced in your whole life is the following. My producer invited Gene Rivers on my radio show several years ago to debate the issue of gay marriage.
Right.
I don't know where you are now. You were against gay marriage at the time.
Yeah.
When he walked, he didn't know who he was debating. When he walked into the studio, it turned out he had to debate one of the people he admired most in the world.
My mentor.
Reverend Peter Gomes from Harvard, who has since passed away.
Yes.
Probably one of the most, the leading, most eloquent voices for gay marriage in America.
In the world.
How'd that feel, Gene Rivers?
First of all, I was scared. It was very good. That was clever. Good for
you,
Brownie.
My pleasure.
That was slick. I walked in there, and I almost had a cardiac arrest. Number one. Here was my mentor at Harvard. He was my faculty advisor. He was my faculty advisor, right?
Wrote beautifully.
Wrote beautifully. Unbelievable. And just brilliant. I mean, there was not a more brilliant person I had met at Harvard, right? And so he puts me up against my mentor, one of the biggest dudes in the world, right?
Yeah.
And I'm in Massachusetts on the wrong side of the issue.
Have you evolved like Barack Obama?
Evolved.
No, I'm serious. That was the word
that was evolution. That was called $50 million and Rosie O'Donnell and David Geffen, evolution.
So where are you today,
Gene Rivers? You give me $50 million, I'll do lots of evolving.
Where are you today?
Today, my position is, I want to finish the first because you had asked me, right? No, right. Number one, the church has failed. And we have compromised our moral authority to take the position that traditionally the church takes on this. So my position is, a gay marriage is non-normative. And it's a philosophical discussion, right? And let's talk about equality. I believe, and I know, all humans are created equal. It does not logically follow that all sexual practices are. All humans are equal, but it doesn't mean all sexual practices are. Now, that's a completely logical position.
Do we want to go here? I'm not sure we want to go here.
Well, I'd actually like to hear what the next sentence is.
No.
That's the end of the sentence, right? So that, and here again,
but
I
it turns
understand.
Out that I think most scientists would say that conclusion is wrong.
Okay,
based upon research.
Are you talking about that some are result in reproduction and others don't?
Procreation. That's one piece of it.
Because lots of people don't have children.
No, I understand that. Mm-hmm. However, now I'm on a hot seat, right?
Yeah.
However, the traditional church position is that human sexuality is for the deepening of love between a man and a woman by definition. So the definition, right? And here you have to accept the definition. But the normative definition is male-female. Now, people can reject it, and I know I'm going to lose, right? I'm in the minority position. The Supreme Court is going to strike DOMA down. Oh, and I know that. So I'm on the losing team and
Striking DOMA down, without giving people a headache, and we're going to get into it in the next couple of days, right. Striking DOMA down, all it does, and it's significant, is in states that already allow gay marriage, like Massachusetts and old New England. Wait, let me finish the thought.
Okay.
Except Rhode Island, it says that you cannot deny federal benefits to those couples if they're allowed to marry in their home state. It does not give a right for a same-sex couple to marry in one of the states that doesn't allow gay marriage or constitutionally prohibits it. That's the proposition.
I understand, but what I'm arguing, listen, my assumption is, you know, in this case, demography is destiny. And the way the thing is trending, right, it is going to be overturned.
Yes, it is.
So I get that. So, you know, I'm not some nut
But let me ask you, though, yes. from a reverend perspective.
Sure.
Because,
pastoral.
You know, pastoral. Okay, excuse me. Because a lot of church people, whether they're black clergy or mm-hmm. Catholic Church yeah. or Southern Baptist, evangelicals,
sure, right.
have a lot of problem with this, and they cite the Bible.
I don't cite the Bible.
You don't cite the Bible.
No.
Okay,
in fact,
so it's not a Bible issue.
No. See, I don't even go biblical on this thing.
Okay.
I make a philosophic argument about my view of the anthropology of human sexuality. Now, that's a complicated discussion. Nobody wants to hear it, because what people really want is my bottom line.
No, but excuse me. But people maybe wanted to hear it a decade or so
I
ago.
Agree.
But people, I would argue that the science has preempted that argument. Virtually, whether it's the American Academy of Pediatrics the other day,
right.
the sciences, whether they're biologists or anybody in between, have suggested it is, to use your word, totally normative.
And
by the way, when you say a second ago, I want to get back to what you said a minute ago, that someone is what, you know, a cheeseburger short of a Nazi or whatever you said.
That was good.
Whatever you said. I don't remember exactly what you said
a
couple minutes ago.
A homophobe.
A pathological.
One of the reasons, I think that criticism has been muted, except for those who are one cheeseburger short of a Nazi, and some anti-gay marriage people are,
yes, they are. Not,
is because of Barack Obama. I think Obama, and I don't mean because of the color of his skin.
No, I agree with that.
Because he's the President of the United States.
I agree with that.
He's considered a liberal for a handful of years.
Yeah.
I didn't believe that he really wasn't for gay marriage, but decided he wasn't going to come out for gay marriage.
Sure.
And the reality is that his evolution, again, his word.
I don't think it has to do with Barack Obama.
What do you think
all?
It has to do?
I think it has to do with the fact that people have been able to come out of the closet. So the people that when you were little, you had no idea were gay. They were just the maiden aunts and who knows what they were doing, are now up. They're out of the closet.
Sure.
They're raising families. They're respectable members of the community. And you can point to those people and say, I know Susie and she's gay. I know Johnny and he's gay. And they're not horrible people. And they're perfectly entitled to be parents.
Marjorie,
I have a question
for that, though.
I
agree with all that. Now, my view on, let's say, Barack Obama. Obama checked the tea leaves because, number one, he was against it, he was for it, he was against it, he was for it. Now, if that's Mitt Romney, it's called flip-flopping, right?
Right.
If it's Barack Obama,
it's evolution.
Exactly. Okay? Right? Okay, so
yeah,
like the kids say, let's keep this real, right? Okay, and then he gets the pressure. Because you remember, there was a South Carolina case where there was a big vote in South Carolina, and they thought, and the churches came out real hard. And I don't remember
about gay stuff. I don't remember
gay stuff. Yeah. Oh, in fact, that's the thing.
You mean the
constitutional
amendment? Are you talking about?
Was
a vote on a constitutional amendment. I think the same day as a primary or some such thing.
That's exactly.
But can I get back to your let's get real for a second?
Yes.
Okay. Two people who have a lot of respect for you say, Reverend, I want to talk to you.
Yes.
I'm a man. He's a man. I'm a woman. She's a woman. We want to get married, and we want your blessing. We're in a state that allows gay marriage. We hear you have some issue with it. What do you say to those people who respect you, who look to you for leadership?
You know what I do, really? I mean, and I've actually had a couple of instances like this that involve children. I listen, because the church is so compromised. And I want to be real clear, the church is so
morally.
The church is in general. Just across the board, right? It's so morally compromised. Right? That not until the church, A, listens, exhibits genuine compassion for people, regardless of what this is the deeper issue. My friends, the church doesn't have a problem with homophobia. The church has a problem with sex. The gays didn't even get it right. No, the gays didn't even get the story right. No. It's not that they have a problem with you. No. The church has sinned against the world with a real uncompassionate view of human sexuality. They're not better on women. I mean, for the gays to jump up and down, right, and howl about that. Whoa, hold up, time out. Are they better on women, dude?
No.
Really? No, of course not.
Some churches are better than women.
So the issue is not homophobia. The issue is sexuality. And the church has been uncompassionate and hypocritical. So my view on this, I live in New England, which is one of the great places to live if you have the dissenting philosophic position that I do, right? But the church has to listen and learn, because part of the business with the gay business now, right now, people are riding the crest of a wave of sympathy. And it doesn't really involve a lot of understanding. For me, when I think
it's exactly the opposite. I think it is what Marjorie said. It's total understanding. It's exposure to just like when people hadn't met blacks 30 or 40 years ago. Oh, my God. Bill Cosby has a family just like my family. Oh, my God, my neighbors. I didn't know those two women were married. They take care of their kids exactly like I take care of my kids.
Let me push back on the black analogy. One of the things that gets me
That's what the problem is. The moral equivalency is what drives you nuts, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. No, let me tell you something. Hold on, y'all. Hold up.
You're talking to me?
No, I'm talking to you. I mean, you're talking to me? I'm talking to you, right. No, look. When the argument came out that said that 400 years of lynching, and when they analyzed, I said, no,
gays never, by the
no,
way.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Jim, listen, I got invited down. A great gay group did a marvelous documentary on the Goodwin case and the winning of marriage.
Goodrich.
Thank you.
The two women that got married.
So the gays said, let's have some fun. Let's invite Rivers to be the skunk at the party. So I was invited. There were 600 gay folk. They did this great documentary, right? And they said, well, we're going to have Rivers down here, and he's supposed to be the caveman to come in and say something stupid. I said, well, since I didn't get an honorarium, right, I'm going to give you your money's worth. So I said, listen, I applaud you people. I disagree, but I applaud your effort. I understand the issues. I'm willing to listen. Now, I'm not probably going to change my mind tomorrow, but I'm willing to have a rational dialogue around honest differences of opinion. And that's all I'm asking.
Incidentally, we got an email from the spirit of Reverend Gomes. And you know what it said, Gene? TikTok is what it said.
Oh, absolutely.
The clock is ticking.
I agree.
Reverend Eugene Rivers III, it's great to see you, Gene.
We didn't resolve this.
We'll resolve it by
thing,
next week.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
Reverend Rivers, it's great to see you. We'll see you next Monday.
Thank you so much.
Boston Public Radio keeps you connected to all corners of the globe, so it's only fitting that right now, your contribution in any amount means you're automatically entered to win a trip for two to Hong Kong, including airfare, four-star hotel, island tours, culinary adventures, and more, thanks to the Hong Kong Tourism Board and General Tours World Travelers of Keene, New Hampshire. Enter to win when you give online at wgbhnews.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books. And Xfinity Home from Comcast, the new home security and home control solution where you can watch your kids get home safely without actually being there or control your home from anywhere. You can learn more at xfinity.com/home.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Just a couple of weeks ago, we spoke to a former president of Trader Joe's who said he hoped to open a market in Boston with food purchased from supermarkets that was past the expiration date, but still perfectly fine. Well, our guest today has taken this one step further, specifically to the dumpster. Joining us to describe his ambitious plans is tough student Maximus Thaler. Maximus, great to see you.
Hi.
Hey, let me just say, this looks fabulous, whatever this is. And by the way, if you want to weigh in and give a call or ask questions about freeganism, for lack of a better expression, you'll learn about it in a minute. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Okay, well, Maximus, explain to us what you're doing here. You've been doing some very constructive dumpster diving.
Yeah.
And why and what have you come up with here?
Is my mic?
No, we're fine. Yeah. You're good.
All right. So I started dumpster diving as rigorously as I'm doing now last summer because I moved into an apartment with my friends in Somerville and we needed food. And I was like, okay, because I'd been dumpstering for the past 3 or 4 years, but just occasionally. And
Wait a second. When you use the word dumpstering, does that mean reaching into dumpsters to get food?
It means hopping into dumpsters.
Hopping into dumpsters.
And getting food.
And getting food.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. I just want to understand the terminology.
Did your mother know you were doing this, Maximus?
Yeah.
A little closer to the mic, Maximus. Sorry. Okay, so it started then, and then take us through the history.
So I found that in a single night, in a couple hours, I could go into the dumpster and pull out, like, literally thousands of dollars worth of food. And it was absurd. Like,
were these supermarket dumpsters?
Restaurant dumpsters would be no good.
Okay.
Supermarket dumpsters, everything's wrapped in plastic. And like, you find things that are just, like, very iconic. Like, there'll be a dozen eggs, and one or two of them will be cracked. Mm-hmm. And so nobody's going to buy a dozen eggs, so they throw them away. because the way that a supermarket is set up, it's, you know, it's a supermarket. It's meant they're marketing products. They're not marketing food. And their intention is to make a profit selling these labeled packaged items. They're not trying to feed people. So if something ever becomes not sellable, they throw it away.
Now, Maximus, just in case, as we have this discussion, as it goes ahead at 877-301-8970, if people have questions, assuming that people want to get involved in dumpstering, when you describe what you brought, which I have to say is quite beautiful, what do you wear when you go dumpstering?
I wear clothes that I'm willing to get messy. I mean, it is a dumpster. Like, yeah. there's you know, rotten fruit and mm-hmm. all those sort of things. But you bring it home and you wash it off, and then it's just as good as what you'd buy from the store.
Okay, what do you wash it off with?
Water.
Just regular water?
Water and soap.
Okay, I got the egg thing totally, because, you know, you figure, okay, a couple of them are cracked and you haven't cooked the eggs. You can just mm-hmm. boil the eggs. They're boiled. They're okay. Now, you, however, have brought us, like, fruit.
I've brought you fruit. I've brought you New York strip steak.
Was this wrapped up? Was this wrapped up?
Yeah,
so it wasn't like just lying there.
No,
the strawberry.
No, of course not. The strawberries come in plastic packaging.
Okay.
The steak comes in plastic packaging. A lot of the meat expires that day, or uh-huh. or like this steak was very interesting in that like the label maker misprinted, and so it said it expires in 2011, and so I was okay, cool, I'll take it. So it's there's a lot of reasons why food gets in the dumpster. It's very rarely because the food is actually bad.
And by the way, if you want to see a photo of all the food that Maximus has brought, you can go to our Twitter page at Boss, B-O-S, Public Radio. And you can check. I have to say, yeah. looking at it, for it actually looks totally.
There's a lot of pictures on my website as well.
What's your website?
Thegleanerskitchen.org.
Speaking of the Gleaner's Kitchen, let's go from the small to large. You have a plan here.
Yeah.
Your goal is not just to eat decently and not just cheaply, but for free. Your goal is to do what with this movement?
My goal is to create a community space, because the fundamental assumption that
can
I want
to... Have a strawberry while you're talking or not?
Absolutely,
okay.
Yeah. The assumption that I want to question is that you know, food is a product.
I'm gonna eat this.
Yeah, I want to create a space where I'm giving out free food, and the point is not to sell food, but rather to foster a community, because food has this incredible way of bringing people together. And, you know, I think that sharing food with one another is one of the most important things that we do as humans.
And if people came, and this is one of these things from what I've read, if you're able to put this together, mm-hmm. if you can't afford anything, you can't afford it. If you can, you pay what you can, that ultimately will
yeah.
keep it going.
Yeah, because, more than anything else, the dumpster is, like, really, really, like, profoundly shaken my sense of value. Like, I'll show you this. Here, like, this is the box that I brought the food in. Like, I find all these stickers in the dumpster mm-hmm. and say $3.99, $2.99. And it's like, there's all of these prices associated with this food, and I don't know what it means anymore. And value is different for different people. People come from different socioeconomic classes and all these things. But an apple is an apple. And that whatever the value of an apple is universal. And I don't think it's fair to, you know, charge these sort of put food on a monetary metric.
Maximus, do you ever buy any? What percentage of the food that you consume, you personally, comes from a dumpster?
Well, I live in a co-op house, and so I would imagine probably about 60%, and
wow.
we do buy food. But this summer, it was 100%.
Now,
so you go around during the day with your friends or by yourself?
With my friends.
And get stuff out of the dumpster and then mm-hmm. come home and figure out what was good and what wasn't good and preserve the good and cook it.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
So you say, just to put this in context, when you're sitting around with your friends and let's say there isn't either a game or a movie on that you want to see, you mm-hmm. say, let's go dumpstering, and then you just go
yeah.
and then find... And I assume, and I don't want you to give this away unless you want to, I assume there's some, not all dumpsters are created equally.
No,
I assume
not all dumpsters
there's
are created
some supermarkets
equal.
That really take pretty good care of the food that's still packaged and some which don't. Yes?
I'll correct you a little bit.
Okay.
Every single supermarket in this country throws away $1,000 to $2,000 worth of food every night. The question is not, you know, which is a better dumpster, but rather which dumpsters are more accessible. Because the bigger grocery stores, they have trash compactors. But, you know, they think they're being eco-friendly by mm-hmm. smushing all their trash into a tiny space, but they're throwing away profound amounts of food. Like, it's absurd.
Because of the expiration date has
yeah.
arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Are those
okay.
flowers from a dumpster
those
as well?
Those flowers are from a dumpster. Here, this is fresh squeezed watermelon, cantaloupe, grapefruit, mango juice.
Oh, so,
like,
around.
We juice a lot of fruit that is, you know, bruised or going bad, because when you juice it, it has a new life.
You know what? One of the things, we're going to get to your calls now, 877-301-8970.
Okay, that's delicious.
How is it?
It's delicious.
You know, we've only been doing this 5 weeks now, the show, Margaret.
I don't know.
We could do a remote from a dumpster at some point. No, I'm serious. And you could help, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's take a call from Maximus Thaler. He's here. John, you're in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. You're on with Maximus, a freegan who wants to, I guess, change the way the world eats. Go ahead, John.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Fine,
excellent.
Thanks.
The juice is spectacular, by the way. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I understand he wants to save money, but I just got to ask, what's the biggest rat he ever saw in a dumpster?
I'm so glad you asked because I wanted to and I didn't know how to ask. John, bless you. Okay, what's the answer to the question?
I have never found animals in the dumpster.
That's not true.
That is true. I mean, because, you know, you can time it right. The grocery stores, they close at 10, right? And you go, you know, most of the time when I go to the dumpster, the food's only been there for a couple hours. And it's, you know.
When do they dump it? Right after they close?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they dump all day. I mean, you get – there's a spectrum. But, like, okay. The food has never been in there for more than 12 hours. And in the middle of the winter, it's like a fridge.
John,
point.
Thanks for the call. How big – I mean this. Marjorie and I talked about this in our former life on a former show. How big a movement is this? I mean, some people do it for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. Some do it for financial reasons and or reasons of the environment, because why are we wasting all this food that's perfectly edible? How big a deal is this? Or is this, like, on the margins?
I mean, it's difficult for me to say. I know that on the very popular nights I go to dumpsters, I'll meet, like, probably sometimes 15 other dumpster divers who, like, know the right spots. And but it is a very fringe culture thing just because it's so, like, viscerally unappealing. Oh, you get your food out of a dumpster? But as soon as you see the food, it changes your perspective.
And who are the other dumpster divers, assuming they're not with the freegan movement? Who are they?
Many, many dumpster divers live in cooperative housing because that's the only way that you can really utilize this food effectively, because you get, you know, hundreds of eggs or, you know, you get a lot of one thing and you don't really get the choice to be like, oh, I want like half a pound of cheese.
Right.
And, like, you get what you get when you get it. And so you need a large kitchen and a lot of mouths in order to utilize the food effectively.
A lot of former radio talk show hosts couldn't get a new gig actually doing that. 877-301-8970. If you have a question about dumpstering or freeganism, what's the law say? Are you allowed to, it's not your property, that dumpster. Are you allowed to be in it? Or what's the deal?
The law is very mixed. So there's as far as dumpstering is concerned, there was an interesting Supreme Court case in 1988 where it was actually the ruling was meant to protect the police. The police went searching through a drug dealer's garbage and, you know, found evidence of narcotics dealing, and they used that to prosecute him. And the dealer brought the case up to the Supreme Court saying, like, oh, you went through my garbage. You didn't have a warrant. That's, you know, a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And the Supreme Court ruled that no, garbage placed out for public collection is in the public domain and anyone can search through it. So there's that. There is some trespassing that is involved, but, you know, depending on, like, if the dumpster is behind a gate or things like that. So it's a very fishy sort of.
Well, you know, speaking of, but if I can, our producers are coming up with tons of things they're interested in you answering. Speaking of law, how do you get around the laws prospectively? If you're able to put this cafe mm-hmm. thing together, you're serving food that was thrown out.
Yes.
And to customers who mm-hmm. are either paying or not paying. That's their choice.
Not paying. Definitely not paying.
But some can make a contribution. Is that how you get around that?
But what I'm very, very, like, yes, it's a loophole against the law, but it's also very deliberately, I am not selling food, and food is not the thing that, like, if you're donating to me, you're donating for the space that I'm creating, not the commodity that I'm producing. So the in 1996, it's called the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Act, which Clinton signed, which says basically that if you are distributing food, if you're donating food to people, as long as it's not bad due to gross negligence, as long as I'm not poisoning it or, like, know that it has, you know that it's really whatever it is, you're allowed to give away food for free and you're exempt from a lot of legal liability.
Maximus, roughly what percentage of the food you end up finding in a dumpster from a supermarket, what percentage is usable and edible, and what percent has gone bad, roughly?
Probably 75% is usable.
Is usable.
Yeah.
And I just want to be clear, too. When you have this meal every night at around 6 o'clock, so mm-hmm. the people that want to join would come into the meal, and you'd all sit down together and eat.
Yeah.
You, okay.
Yes.
And in your co-op housing, where you've been serving this dumpster gotten food, mm-hmm. what's your favorite do you have a couple of favorite meals that you think that have been your sort of pièce de résistance of the because you're obviously very talented. Look at the way he's arranged all these
beautiful. The presentation is beautiful.
The presentation is gorgeous. I mean, do you have a favorite couple of meals?
Yeah, I mean, what I cook is largely determined by what we get. So, you know, there's a lot of roasted potatoes. I really love the fancy meats. I mean, the amount of the kinds of, you know, I get, like, filet mignon and scallops and wild Alaskan salmon and prosciutto. And, like, so it's absurd. Like, I eat better than I will ever be able to afford.
And again, they're throwing out the fish because it's reached its expiration date. And it doesn't smell fishy?
But it smells like fish. It doesn't smell bad.
Oh, my God.
What time should we be there for dinner tonight?
6 p.m. I'm cooking.
You know, our number is 877-301-8997. And by the way, you don't see, well, you see the pictures on our Twitter page. Is it your picture on your own website?
Yeah.
What's your website thing?
TheGleanersKitchen.org.
And you were a totally normal... You're a normal, average guy.
Well, we have no idea. He could be a total
lunatic. relatively normal.
Let me ask you just about your life, though. How did you get into this? Was this something as a little kid that you were
interested in? I always want to be dumpstering. He said when he was three years old.
Did you start doing this at Tufts, or what happened?
I started doing it at Tufts. I think the first time I went dumpstering was my freshman year.
Was it a course you took that sort
of
opened your eyes?
No, it was more just like my friends were like, hey, let's go to the dumpster. We can get all this juice. And so we went to the juice dumpster.
Really?
And got, you know, probably like 50 gallons of like fresh squeezed juice.
So this goes to contrary to the stereotype that, you know, everyone's at Tufts and everybody's got, either they've got a scholarship or they've got parents that were able to send them there. You don't think of college students at Tufts being in desperation for juice.
Well, I mean, what do you mean by desperation? I mean, that, you know, people...
I think I would have to feel a little bit desperate to go to a dumpster.
But Maximus, this isn't about finances. It sounds like a lot of your friends who are into this are into it for environmental reasons or save the world kinds of reasons, not because you save the money.
I mean, it's a combination of both. I don't have the money to eat like this, and I like good food, you know, but it's not... Like, yes, I am of sufficient means that I could go out and buy my own food if I had to.
So you and a bunch of students started doing this your freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then it evolved after that into, I mean, what made you think, because it's a very revolutionary idea that we should not be selling food. That's an unusual thought, Maximus.
Yeah.
How'd you get from dumpster diving to this whole
thing? Wait a second. Before he answers that question, the guy who's running Panera, which is one of the fastest growing food chains in the United States of America, has a variation on the theme. If you go down to government center, you pay nothing if you don't want to pay anything.
Well, but people are contributing. He's still selling
the
food.
Some are, some aren't.
But you're talking about something different, not selling the food.
Mm-hmm. I just have like a very deep-seated distrust of money, I guess, and I really don't like that there's this one metric of, you know, this gray-green metric that we use to assign value to everything we do. Everything in this society boils down to how much is it worth, and there's just so much that falls through the cracks when you do that, and I don't like. I would prefer my sense of value to be much more broad.
Let's squeeze another call or two in. Jennifer, you're in Newton, and you're on with Maximus Thaler, who's leading this freegan movement over there at Tufts and beyond. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi. First of all, I think it's absolutely great what you're doing. You're bringing sort of some visibility to a really important issue, which is just incredible waste of food that we have in this country. And you're also feeding yourself. But assuming that you're trying to sort of make a broader point with what you're doing, I'm wondering... What do you think are the efforts that we could do in this country, both the restaurant level, the store level, to divert some of this waste, the waste stream?
Great question, actually. How about it, Maximus?
I mean, that is a really good question. Frankly, I don't know the best answer to it. I mean, my answer is very radical, is saying that food should not be products anymore. There's all of this notion of like, oh, I want wheat thins or I want English muffins. And like people are used to food as these like packaged, standardized, like little bits with brand names and logos and all of these things. And I really think that has corrupted our sense of what food is, what good food is. When I think about food, I think of raw ingredients. I think of flour or rice or garlic or meat. And I think that the way food should be distributed and sold is not as these labeled packaged things, but as ingredients for people to use.
Jennifer, thanks for the call. We're going to squeeze in one or two more quick ones. A lot of calls. Mark, you're in Westwood. You're on with Maximus, and you know what he's doing here. Hey, Mark.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hey, I think this is just a great thing that you're doing, and it's something that's been a big question of mine every time I walk into a Whole Foods or a Wegmans, and I see just the vast quantities of food, all sorts of things, more food than they could ever sell in a day, and I always said to myself, what do they do with it at the end of the day? They can't possibly sell it all.
You have a bad connection, Mark. Thank you for the call. I mean, some of it's donated. I do know that there are some places that donate food that hasn't expired but is getting close.
Yeah.
Some supermarkets donate it to food pantries and that sort of
stuff. A lot of it is a distribution issue. Like, I mean, it's not like these supermarkets are being like, oh, yeah, we're going to, like, be really wasteful. It's more just like the way their business model is set up, they have to buy excess. I mean, that's what that caller was saying. They have to buy more than they can sell because they need to look full. And so there's all this excess, and they don't know what to do with it. And it costs more to pay their employees to sort the good eggs from the bad than it does for them to just throw it away. So, you know, I feel I I envision myself or see myself as like closing this loop of like, you know, being sort of a scavenger, being a, you know, the part of the ecosystem that takes use of waste and reuses it.
Let's take one last quick one. Alexander, you're in Gloucester. You're going to wrap things up with Maximus Thaler. Hey, Alexander.
Thank you. I just was wondering, last year I got ServSafe certified. This is the certification the National Restaurant Association requires if you're going to serve food to the public. The number one rule of food distribution is you need to get your food from a reputable source. And I'm wondering how your guest is getting around that number one rule.
How about it, Maximus?
So the question is, what is reputable? Because the reason the food is in the dumpster is because the FDA is a reputable source that says that, oh, you know, this food expires at this date. But I consider myself reputable, and I can look at the food, and I can smell it and taste it and say whether or not it's good. So it's a question of trust. And me and my friends are the ones that are preparing the food, and if you're eating it from us, it's this implicit, you know, I trust you to feed me something that's safe.
You ever gotten sick? Alexander, thanks.
You're not selling it, too,
no,
which,
I'm not
is, which
selling
it makes it different than
you ever gotten
than
sick from
I have not once gotten sick.
Now, I have to ask you, Maximus, you were wearing a very interesting coat. Where did you get that coat?
I made it myself.
You made your coat?
Yeah. I also made all of the dishes that you're eating
you
off
You made
of.
The dishes. You dumpstered. Is that correct? You dumpstered the food? Can mm-hmm. we use that as a verb
yes.
in that context?
What is the coat made out of?
It's made out of wool and felt.
Unbelievable. You know, my kids are hitting me up for more money all the time. This kid is over here at Tufts.
Give Maximus his cell phone. Maximus okay. Thaler, give us your website one last time, please.
It's thegleanerskitchen.org, and don't forget the article, because there's another Gleaners Kitchen in New York without the article.
Good for you. Great, you're doing great stuff. Okay. You're very impressive, young guy. Maximus, thanks so much for your
time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for bringing the food, too. It's great.
It was great. Okay, up next, another kind of different view of living. How can 400 square feet of living space feel spacious and help you with your happiness quotient? We'll talk to a man who's figured that out by living small. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Crystal Bowersox grew up with hard times, but her grit, grace, and talent made her a star on American Idol and beyond.
The struggles and tragedy and every moment that has led me to now. Just, I'm so grateful for.
Crystal Bowersox tells us about her new album, All That for This, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Gentle Giant Moving Company, celebrating more than 30 years of moving antiques and art, including local moving, long distance moving, full service storage, and art and furniture restoration. More at gentlegiant.com. And 180 days. Discover the fight to keep children in class and reform efforts alive inside a challenging school district. Don't miss 180 days, a year inside an American school. Monday at 9 on WGBH 2.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. As some of you know, I am rather large. But the prospect of living small has great appeal to me. Joining us is a man whose recent piece in the New York Times ended. I love this final line. My space is small. My life is big. He's the founder of treehugger.com. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Graham Hill. How are you, Graham?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for
being here. Thank you. This is a fascinating story. So tell people, I mean, you had tons of money, but you went from a different kind of lifestyle to this 420-square-foot apartment. How'd you go from the big time to the little teeny tiny time, Graham?
Well, it was a bit of a slow process, but I ended up moving to New York, and so at one point I had basically seven – I was sort of landlord here and there. I had a bunch of roommates, and ended up selling the house. It was just too much to manage, and then ended up falling in love with a Spanish woman and moving to Barcelona into a small space, and then – when I started Treehugger in 2004, it was virtual, and so we ended up, she ended up working in an orphanage in Cambodia, I moved to Bangkok, and long story short, we just ended up living abroad in Buenos Aires, Toronto, and a whole bunch of other cities, and with a couple bags, doing work that mattered to us, both my cup company, we were happy to serve you, and Treehugger. And we just had great experiences, and we were, you know, hard at work on projects that were meaningful to us. And really, basically, had two bags. And so sort of in that process, I realized that this was a less complicated, simpler life, that it was a
Well, you know, when you read your piece, I mean, you talk about, and it is so true, how you have to have the furniture to fill up the house. And then you have to worry about, you know, mowing the lawn and cleaning the gutters and cleaning up the whole house. And because you had a big, huge house, you need a lot of roommates to fill it. You even had to hire a personal shopper. So you're right. You are spending an awful lot of time, you know, managing these homes. On the other hand, 420 square feet, that's pretty tiny.
Yeah, it's pretty small, but, I mean, so our basic idea is that if you're smart about the layout, the design, the technology, and the behavior change, that you can make really compelling smaller spaces. And so, you know, this is only 420 square feet, but really it has the functionality of an apartment at least twice its size. So I'm able to have guests over in a civil manner. I have sit-down dinners for 10 or 12. I have a nice home office. I have a big, clean bed. Lots of storage. So the whole thing really ties together nicely through transforming furniture and a moving wall and just a good layout and then just being smart about what possessions I have.
Yeah, speak to us about the – I used to live in the West Village in New York City when I was in law school, and I'm guessing my apartment was the 420-square-foot range, not by choice. Mm-hmm. By the way, that's all I could afford. But when I read in your piece, as you said a minute ago, your apartment could sleep four comfortably, frequently have dinner parties, as you said, for 12 people – I barely fit in this apartment myself, Graham. So what kind of give us a description of how you efficiently use space so you don't feel like a sardine in your house.
So the main idea with this one is basically it's sort of three-ish rooms. But the main one is quite large and open, and it transforms. And so there's a nice L couch, and there's a company called Resource Furniture, and you pull down the bed, it's a nice, solid, queen-size Murphy bed that folds over the couch. When I have guests, there's a moving wall that I pull out. It sort of runs on track, floor to ceiling. I pull that out and that revealing some bunk beds, also Resource Furniture, that fold out of the wall. And then to create sort of further sequester off those two rooms, we have some nice thick curtains that run in the track on the ceiling that come out of a pocket in the wall and magnet to the end of the wall. So thereby creating sort of two nice spaces. So that's the guest room and the master. I have a stand-up sort of slash sit-down office, which is very simply a drawer that pulls out of the wall, and then a nice monitor on an arm and with a little Mac Mini in the closet. So very simple but really effective home office. And then for dining, the main space, basically there's a table called the Goliath. We have sort of built the kitchen counter around. So I just pull that out, and it's about, I don't know, a foot wide. And it stretches out to, 8 or 10 feet, something like that. And so then I have stacking chairs and a bunch of leaves in the closet. And so all of a sudden the space is occupied by this big table with 10 chairs. So I can easily do that.
Where do you keep the pool table, Graham? Hey, Graham, how strange, you know, when you read your piece, and I hope people will, if you Google it in the New York Times, it's Living with Less, a Lot Less is the title of the piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago. How do your friends look at you? I know if there's a story here, and if you read it, and you started telling the story to Marjorie a couple of minutes ago, the evolution, for lack of a better sense, you can understand where you are. But if people just meet you, and here you live in a 420-foot space, don't know your background, don't know what you can afford, what kind of reactions do you get to your lifestyle, the way you choose to live?
Well, I mean, New York City, like as you just said, you know, you lived in a small space, and a lot of people do. So, you know, that's not that abnormal in some of our larger cities, certainly New York. What's more abnormal is just the amazing amount of functionality that I get out of it. And so, let me tell you, I've probably done 25 dinners in the last 6 months.
Wow.
I've had, I don't know, 20 people to stay in the space. I want people to really experience it in person. And people really like it. You know, we've done a good job, and we've done basic things like just really good insulation and really good windows. So it's really quiet. You don't actually hear your neighbors or the street. And just, you know, it's the basics are simple. So it's actually a really lovely place to live. And once people experience it, they're like, oh, yeah, okay, I get this.
Do you ever miss having stuff?
Not in the least. Let me be clear. Like, I love stuff, and I covet stuff just like anyone else. But our point is less but better. So just be a lot more conscious about what you bring into your life and have some great things. And, you know, think about stuff that's gonna, that you're going to like for a while, that's going to look good in 10 years, that's going to be last or be or repair, easily repaired. If you think about it, many things, if whatever it is twice as expensive but lasts four times as long, then it's half price. So this can actually be a great way to do it. Now, one argument to that as well, if you can't afford it, then you can't afford the upfront. So, and that's absolutely true. It's, you know, it's a little harder to do if you don't have the money to do it. But I think that generally we're just trying to push people to be a lot more conscious in what they bring into their lives and understand that stuff, it takes up more than just physical space. It takes up mental space. And there's just a lot of things that come with it that you don't really think about when you're spellbound by the prospect of how much happier you're going to be once you get that thing.
You
forget about the maintenance, and you forget about the fact that at some point you're going to want to get rid of it and sell it or recycle it. And just there's storing it and maintaining it. And there's a lot that comes with stuff.
We're talking with Graham Hill, who went from a 3,600-square-foot house in Seattle in a frenzy of consumption, as he described in this New York Times piece, this little 420-square-foot studio apartment. You know, you just touched on something, Graham, that I think is really fascinating to people. How getting rid of all this stuff affects your contentment and your happiness and your general peace?
I mean, I think we live really overwhelming lives, and particularly with the addition of smartphones and iPads and email, and just like there's a lot going on. So, you know, anything you can do to sort of simplify and fragment yourself less, I think is a really good thing. I mean, I think understanding that life is actually about experiences and about connection, about relationships, and that, you know, study after study will show that the thing that you're so excited about that's going to change your life, it normalizes very quickly. And also that just, you know, in terms of happiness levels and salary, which, you know, largely will affect the amount of stuff that you have, but, you know, happiness levels climb rapidly from 0 to 10K to 20 as you get a roof over your head and you're not worried so much about food. But then it really starts to taper off, and it pretty much flatlines around 75K. So the reality is that we've sort of sold this concept that, you know, the richer you get, the happier you're going to get. But the reality is, I think once you've sort of got most things under control and you can go to dinner when you want, and maybe take some vacation, and it doesn't actually get that much better from there. And in fact, may make your life more stressful. All of a sudden, being super rich and having a bunch of places in various Hawaii, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And it's just the things that you have to actually worry about, and staff and management and details. And the reality is, you know, life's about friends and family and doing cool things together and that sort of stuff, and not really about all this other stuff.
But,
less stuff, just simpler.
But one last thing, Graham. I mean, you are living by yourself. You know, you're not married with a bunch of kids. Right. So I presume that you couldn't. I mean, we all want to have relationships, but I think I'd go bananas if I had, you know, two kids or three kids.
Absolutely. So that's a common fan. And, you know, the challenge at this point in our evolution is we've only got one space to really show. So we're not trying to say, A, that this is aesthetic. It has nothing to do with aesthetic. B, that it's people should be living in 420 square foot spaces. We're saying that this is one option. And our main thing is we should be able to live in less square feet per person.
Hey, Graham Hill, great piece.
Yep.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're out of time. Great piece in the New York Times.
Great piece.
He's the founder of LifeEdited.com and TreeHugger.com. Graham Hill. Graham, thanks so much.
Thank you, Graham.
I want to thank you guys. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us, as always, on the web at WGBHnews.org/PPR. On the eve of 2 days of oral argument on gay marriage before the Supreme Court, we'll have pro and anti leaders debate what the Supreme Court will do and what they should do. And then a language columnist talks about how poor kids, this is amazing, hear just one-third as many words as upper-income young people do in their homes. We'll discuss why that is and what the consequences are. It's all tomorrow on Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
Thanks for tuning in. Talk to you tomorrow at noon. Bye.